Thank you again for your invitation. I think it might be easiest for me to stand so that I can see also what it is that you are seeing on the screen as well. As I mentioned, we'll be looking in the course of the next four lectures at a most remarkable resource for the study of ancient imagery. These are seals preserved as impressions on two very important groups of tablets from Persepolis, one known as the Fortification Archive, the other as the Treasury Archive. I'll be concentrating on the material from the Fortification since it is less well known than the material from the Treasury Archive. There are lots of interesting things that this imagery raises for us. In the course of these four lectures, I shall be concentrating on the ideological character of this imagery and how this imagery constitutes what we can think of as an imaginary landscape at Persepolis at the end of the 6th century. Another thing that we'll be concentrating on in these lectures are what we can conceptualize as the social character of these images, and that is how images are used at Persepolis as a means of negotiation, and that is a means of negotiation between different classes of individuals, different social statuses, how images and the elite function in this very interesting environment at Persepolis. So these will be some of the overarching aims of these lectures. And certainly in the second lecture, when we talk about the seals of Zishawish, we'll be looking at the social character of this imagery. And in the last lecture on attempt to integrate these images into our understanding of Nongshi Rustam, Persepolis, to a lesser degree, Bisitun, we'll be looking at the ideological character of the imagery. Now, of course, I'm sure all of you here know about the history of the study of ancient seals. This are a series of seals coming from many different periods, both stamp and cylinder seals. You will also be aware that the cylinder seal appears at the end of the fourth millennium and then becomes the major sealing medium until stamp seals reappear again in the first millennium. At Persepolis, we have both stamp and cylinder seal impressions. In the history of the study of glyptic, traditionally one has focused on the ancient seals themselves. Seals, of course, were highly valued as collectible items. They were acquired by museums and private collectors. And of course, we study them today traditionally by making a modern impression of the ancient seal. Here are two unprovenanced examples of a stamp seal and a cylinder seal from the Achaemenid period. Of course, another large body of material through which glyptic imagery survives is only as impressions on lumps of clay. Those lumps of clay come in a wide variety of forms. This is a famous example of an impression of an Akkadian cylinder seal. And here, one of these early administrative tablets from Uruk with a seal applied right across here. Now, traditionally, the study of these two forms, that is, the ancient seal that survives with its modern impression and the ancient impression of the seal, have been separate. And in fact, for the most part, scholars have tended to focus on the ancient seals and the modern impressions because they are easier to study. The impressions of seals, the ancient impressions of seals, however, provide a tremendous amount of information that the ancient seals, without a context, provide. Now, the ways that these seals function, these seal impressions, or what we call sealings, function, they can seal doors, boxes, sacks, jars, such as you see here. But of course, they can also be found applied to administrative tablets. And this is one of our tablets from Persepolis. You're looking at the reverse of it with a seal applied across it. So we have a problem in the study of these impressions of ancient seals in that they are very difficult to read. That is, with an ancient seal, we can make a beautiful modern impression of it. With the ancient seal impression, we are left with whatever the ancient user left us. Most of the time, that imagery is fragmentary and oftentimes very difficult even to read. So we have an interesting kind of dichotomy here in the sense that the ancient seal is a beautiful object that photographs and looks beautiful, whereas the ancient seal impression is oftentimes not a beautiful object, is oftentimes very difficult to photograph and study. However, especially when these impressions are found on administrative tablets, we have this wonderful archival information that comes with it, and that is one of the reasons that this material from Persepolis is so valuable, because of, I guess you'd call it, the added value that is added by its context. So a modern seal impression can make these beautiful and very artistic impressions. We who study, for the most part, the ancient impressions of seals are left with fragmentary images that have to be painstakingly reconstructed from multiple impressions. So there are lots of gaps and hiatuses that just don't survive on those tablets. Now, the historic context of this material is the Achaemenid Empire during the time of the reign of Darius I, during the early and middle years of his reign. But from time to time, we will also have a chance to talk a little bit about some of the earlier periods, and especially the period of Cyrus. This, of course, is a map of the empire. I have added onto this map the continuation of the royal road down to Persepolis. This Susa-Persepolis nexus is very important in the fortification archive. And I've also, rather freely and with no pretensions of accuracy, attempted to indicate that the road, of course, continues to the east. This is oftentimes forgotten. In fact, this map was taken, I believe, from the British Museum publication, and the royal road only goes from Sardis to Susa, as if it stopped. And of course, it stops at Susa because that's what our Greek sources say, that it stopped at Susa. We, of course, know that it continued on. And in fact, the road is a series of roads. It's not just one road that makes up this communication system. And this road between Susa and Persepolis is, in fact, very important because it provides sort of the internal structure for the organization of the administration as represented in the fortification archive. We will be focusing mainly on the heartland of the empire, that is Persia and Elam. Here now is a detailed topographic map. Here is that nexus of Susa and then Persepolis down here with the road, I believe, this is a detail of the area of Persepolis. Let me go back here. This nexus of Susa and Persepolis is an ancient nexus. And in fact, it reaches back into the earlier Elamite periods when there was conceptualized as this kind of dichotomy between the highland as represented by Anshan, that is the highland Elamite area, and then the lowlands represented by Susa. So this Susa-Persepolis nexus is a continuation of a millennia-old tradition of contact between these two areas. The heartland of the empire proper, that is Persia or Pars. Now we're looking out over the Marv Dash plain, the Takht at Persepolis and Nakshi Rustam, where the royal tombs are. We'll be looking a lot at the royal tombs, or especially the royal tomb of Darius at Nakshi Rustam, because one of the interesting things that our archive does is it provides a wonderful background to the imagery on that tomb, which I think has been lacking to date, and perhaps is one of the reasons that that relief is ignored or overshadowed by its more famous relative at Bissi Tun. here we now, we're looking out over the Marv Dash with the talk at Persepolis, and then on to Nongshi Rustam, which you can't see in that photograph. Of course, many of you will be aware of the plan of Persepolis with the platform proper, the fortification wall, and then the lower city, and an aerial view taken in the course of the excavations in the 1930s by the University of Chicago. Now, Persepolis, at the time of Darius I, did not, of course, have all of these buildings. Darius, in fact, was the person who initiated building at Persepolis. What was at Persepolis that we can definitively say was at Persepolis at the time of Darius was the terrace and the fortifications. There was an entrance at the south over here. Of course, the Apadana was in the process of construction. So too, the Palace of Darius here. There was an earlier phase to the treasury. You can't see that today because of later phases that were built over it. And there must have been administrative centers at Persepolis at this time because we've got these tablets from the Fortification Archive and the Treasury Archive. Where exactly those administrative centers are located, we don't know. We simply have the discovery of the tablets in certain places. The Fortification Archive found in the fortification walls up here at Persepolis, up here in the north, and then the Treasury Archive found in the northern part, rooms of the northern part of the Treasury. Now, clearly with the Treasury tablets, this was not the original context when the archive was active. And there is a lot of debate as to whether the find spot of the Fortification Archive is the actual administrative center as well. We don't really need to get into to that discussion. Here now, just marking off those places that would certainly be under construction and usable at the time of Darius, during which these archives are at work, and then an aerial view, just to give you a feel for the spatial context of these archives. Now, let me address first the Treasury Archive. It is much better known and has been, for the most part, completely published, although there is still some material in Tehran that has not been published. You can see that it dates, in fact, well after the time of Darius, so it's a much longer-lived phenomenon. And it was found in these rooms. In fact, these arrows indicate the major find spots of the Treasury Archive here. This is a shot taken as this northern section of the treasury was being excavated and the tablets were actually being found. They were discovered in the 30s, 1936 to 38. It's a smallish archive. 138 Elamite tablets have been published. There are many, many fragments, however, that have not been published. There's also an Akkadian text, and then 199 impressions of seals on lumps of clay that today are called labels in English. The Elamite texts document the payment of silver in lieu of food rations to workers. These are partial payments. They're not paying silver in place of all food rations, but they're to compensate the food rations. The number of seals we have, there are 17 cylinder seals on the Elamite tablets, and then 26 cylinder seals and 34 stamp seals on the labels, the so-called labels from the Treasury Archive. You know, although this archive has been known for many years now, it is underutilized as a resource. I think one of the reasons that it's underutilized as a resource is because, certainly from the perspective of glyptic imagery, is that the seals, despite the fact that they were published in one of these large folio volumes, the seals are not published very well. The photographs are not very good, and there are no comprehensive line drawings that are made of them. Here's one of the letter orders from the Treasury Archive. These tablets are fairly large. They're about the size of your hand or a little bit smaller. They are sealed generally on the left edge So these are two different tablets, but this is the left edge over here. So if you turn the, rotate the tablet, you'll see the seal impression on it. I have made it a goal to try to go through and restudy these seals from the Treasury Archive and make good drawings, collated line drawings of them. This is my drawing of seal one here. We'll talk more about these seals in particular here a little bit later. Some of the tablets also are sealed on their upper edge. So here is another Treasury tablet sealed multiple times with this seal, which is Treasury seal number three. And here are an example of some of the labels from the Treasury Archive. You can see they come in various shapes. These are the same seal. In fact, this seal occurs also in the Fortification Archive. And we have four seals that occur on both the Fortification Archive and in the Treasury Archive. And again, just a few more examples of these labels from the Treasury Archive. For the most part, in our lectures this month, I'll be concentrating on the cylinder seals that are preserved on the letter orders, that is the Elamite tablets from the archive. Now, one of the problems is that there's a lot of abbreviations associated with the study of the seals, both from the Treasury Archive and the Fortification Archive, and you'll see them a lot. The most important for the Treasury, PT indicates a tablet, an Elamite tablet from the Treasury. These were published by Cameron. PTS is the siglum we use in front of the seal numbers, so this indicates a seal that's preserved on the Treasury tablets. And as I mentioned, all of these have been published by Schmidt already back in 57. And then we use a convention of an asterisk to indicate a seal that itself is inscribed, that is, there's an inscription actually on the seal. And an S after a seal indicates that it's a stamp seal. So in this case, this indicates without an S that this is a cylinder seal. Now, the Fortification Archive is much richer, much less well-known, and will be the focus of the lectures that I'll be talking about over the next month. I mentioned to you that it was found up here in the fortification wall, and hence the name fortification. The texts themselves have nothing to do with defense or the building of walls, simply indicates the find spot where they were found. This is an aerial view. I apologize, the plan is oriented differently than the photograph, so that north is here and north is here, but this is a nice photograph that shows you these this fortification wall as it was open. You can't see it like this anymore. And this is the area where the archive was found. Actually, the archive was only found in a couple of rooms in this small area of the fortification wall. There are date formulae on the text from the archive that allow us to date it very precisely. And it dates from 509 to 493 BC. So this is the early and middle years, or basically the middle years of the reign of Darius the First. They were discovered actually before the Treasury Archive by Hertzfeld. This is one of the few excavation photographs showing all the tablets as they were being excavated. One gets the sense that the excavation of these tablets was seen as something of an annoyance. They were actually discovered, let me see if I can go back here. No, I can't, it's too far back. But they were discovered in the fortification as Hertzfeld was trying to make a road off of the platform so that he could dump his spoil. And they appear to have been packaged up very rapidly, and almost all of them were sent to Chicago. And when I mean rapidly, I mean they were put in 10 coffee boxes, oftentimes just lumps of unexcavated soil. It's as if they had taken a shovel in the ground, lifted it out, dumped it in a pail, poured wax over it, and sent it to Chicago. You can still today in Chicago come across, in some of the material that hasn't been cleaned, lumps of tablets in soil with wax paraffin wrapped all around it. It's a remarkable thing. Now, after many years of study, we know what this archive does. What it does is it is concerned with the collection of foodstuffs, the taxation of that foodstuff, the storage, and then the transport of those commodities for redistribution as payments to a wide variety of entities, including payments made to the gods. Obviously, the gods are themselves are not eating it, but it's to for sacrifices and also to support religious officials, members of the nobility, to various officials, to travelers on this Susa-Persepolis road, who actually are coming, you know, from all parts of the empire, east and west. Many, many tablets dealing with rations to workers, most of them probably working around Persepolis on the constructions, and also to animals. Animals receive rations for their upkeep as well. Now, the archive is complex. It is not simply one type of document, but several kinds. The first kind are Elamite tablets in clay that have seals on them. So this is the reverse of an Elamite tablet from Persepolis with a seal across it here. These particular type of tablets, which we call the memorandum, are small. They really will fit in the palm of your hand. So they're smaller than the treasury tablets. Then there are, remarkably enough, clay tablets that have ink in Aramaic. Also, sometimes the Aramaic is incised, and sometimes it's both incised and ink, which probably, of course, is just the stylus leaving a mark. And then we have a large number of objects that are tablet-shaped, but they carry no text, neither Elamite nor Aramaic, but they carry cylinder seal they carry stamp and cylinder seal impressions. You can't make it out very well, but there's a seal across here. So three types of documents from this archive. Now, what's interesting, well, there are a lot of things that are interesting, but the one thing that ties all of these documents together are the seals, because all three types of documents are sealed, and we have many examples of seals that occur on Elamite, uninscribed, and Aramaic documents. So in other words, the seals provide, as it were, a linkage between these three types of documentation, even though this documentation, of course, is mute from the textual standpoint. There is no text associated with it. And I've mentioned to you that all of this is dated by date formulae. A little bit of the history of the publication. Halleck's monumental publication of a little over 2,000 of the Elamite texts is still today the primary way that one accesses the Elamite tablets. Margaret Root and I have published the first volume of the seals that appear on the Halleck tablets. Walter Hinkelmann has published an important study on the religious text from the archive. And I don't mean to signal, I've just sort of collected a few of recent publications here. There are many specialized studies that I don't wish to ignore, but I can't acknowledge here for lack of time today. Pierre has published an important synthesis of recent research on the archive and also bringing in earlier material for comparative purposes. And Matthew Stolper has initiated now an online publication program for the many hundreds, indeed thousands, of unpublished documentation. The recoverable archive is unknown, despite the fact that it all is, or what survives of it in Chicago could all be counted. No one's ever done it. There are 7,000 to 10,000, I would say, legible Elamite texts, many hundreds of small fragments that probably will, in my lifetime, never be read. We are just over 700 Aramaic tablets, although as I continue to read through the unpublished boxes, I find Aramaic texts from time to time. But I imagine we no more than 800 Aramaic texts by the end of the project. I don't know how many uninscribed tablets there are. Right now, 5,000 to 6,000 that I can actually see. There may be a couple thousand more, again, by the time the project is over. And then there are a handful of these irregular texts that, in fact, are probably the most famous texts from the archive. There's one in Greek, one in Phrygian, and an old Persian text as well. Well, the abbreviations for the Fortification Archive are even more complicated. and obscure. Again, just for our purposes, the most important ones, PF is the siglum used for a text published by Halleck. NN for an unpublished Elamite text that Halleck had read that Hinkelmann will publish. PFS is the siglum we use for the seals that occur on all the Elamite texts, both PF and NN. And then PFUTS, I fought hard not to have this because it's PFUTS. It just sounds horrible, but nonetheless, I lost that battle. And then again, we use the convention of asterisk and S to indicate a stamp seal. Now, the territory covered by the fortification archive has been well studied, so I'll just go through it really really quickly here. Again, my very abstracted attempt to indicate the Royal Road as it comes through. Those of you who are familiar will know there's a lot of discussion about the path of the road between especially Bebehand and Persepolis, and there may even be more than one that is represented in the archive. The blue dots here, I've put it in as dotted because we don't actually know if the fortification archive is reaching up this far. Again, there's some discussion as to whether or not the administrative district of the archive reaches as far as Susa. At a conservative estimate would put the administrative region of the archive something like this, stretching from Bebehand down to Neriz, with Persepolis at the center. It may go as far north as modern-day Esfahan, and it may extend a little farther south, but this will capture 99% of the transactions that are mentioned in the archive. Well, let's turn and look a little bit now at seals, text, and officials, because this is really what I'm interested in and the main focus of the work that I've been involved in. This is a typical memorandum text over here, and what I've done is I've put for you each of the six faces of the tablet. These memoranda tablets all will have six faces. So here's the obverse of the tablet. The Elamite inscription starts here and reads like this. It then goes on to the bottom edge or the lower edge of the tablet, and then as you roll the tablet, it will continue on to the reverse where a seal will be applied. The upper edge of the tablet, on this case, does not have a cuneiform text, but oftentimes it can, and you can see there's a seal. The right edge is small and oftentimes generally does not carry a seal. The left edge has this distinctive oval, extended oval shape, and is the most common sealing surface that we have in the archive. Now, here are some remarkable statistics for you. 80% or 86% of the Elamite tablets are sealed, 99% of the Aramaic tablets are sealed, and of course, by definition, the uninscribed tablets carry no text and they carry only seals. I put 99.9 because I have found a few tablets that don't have anything on them, neither a seal nor a text, whatever those things are. This is important because if you are familiar with archives from other times and places, you will be struck at just how persistent seal usage is in this archive. In other words, this is a remarkably high percentage of seals being applied to tablets, one of the highest that I know of. I mean, but sealing mattered in this archive. Now, there are lots of different ways that seals are applied to tablets. And in fact, seal protocols is in and of itself a whole lecture. Let me distill it very generally here. We can find 1 to 6 seals on any one tablet. It is very rare to have 6 seals applied on a tablet. You can hardly get 6 seals on these little tablets, so there aren't very many of those. The great majority of the tablets, well over 50% of the tablets, follow one of two types of sealing protocol. The first is where there's just one seal on the tablet, and the second sealing protocol is where there are two seals that are applied on the tablets. You can see here with this example of PF 1772, we have two seals applied, one here here, that's the same seal, and then the second seal applied on the left edge. Now, these the tablets that are sealed with one seal are almost always representing a high administrative authority. So the types of individuals or the types of transactions that have one seal on them will generally involve these kinds of administrators. First of all, the director, Parnaka, and his deputy, I guess you could call him, Zisawish, they each use two different seals. We'll be talking about the seals of Zisawish next week. Then there are regional directors. They are overseeing commodity movements in large areas. They use these three seals here, which I'll show you in just a little bit. Then there are sort of the regional administrators. Seal 2 is an example of that. Then there are these very interesting individuals who are characterized in the Elamite by the term Sharamana or Damana. We'll be talking a lot about these officials. There aren't that many of them. I think maybe 50 to 60 in the whole of the archive. Don't hold me to that. But they perform a wide variety of functions, and they're clearly very important. Anyway, we'll talk a little bit more about them. For the most part, when these Sharamana officials will oftentimes, their seals will occur alone on tablets. There are members of the royal family. Their transactions are always sealed with one seal. There are a few individuals who are authorized to give orders. Those orders are like, take this commodity from here, move it to here, and tell this person to distribute these commodities to this individual. So they're like letter orders from the Treasury Archive. They're very similar to those, but shorter. And they always are sealed only with one seal. And then various officials of high rank whom we sometimes capture in the archive. There are one, maybe two examples of seals that belong to satraps. So those are some examples of individuals who follow the single seal protocol, just one seal applied to the tablet. The other big category are these two seal, or what we call counter seal. These transactions are less transparent and allow for more variation. Now, in principle, and again, this is just a broad principle, and there are lots of caveats, but the seal that will appear on the left edge will be the supplier, that is, the person who is responsible for moving the commodity or delivering the commodity to some place. And then the person who receives that commodity will seal on the upper edge or the reverse or other edges of the tablets. But as I mentioned to you, this is a very general rule, and there are lots of exceptions to that. The one place where you can be very certain that you've got this kind of seal protocol are the travel rations, and there are almost 1,000 of these travel rations, so there are a lot that constitutes a large part of the archive. And always in there, the supplier will be on the left edge, the receiver on the reverse. Now, I just thought as an experiment, we might look at this tablet, which literally I selected at random. I happened to be interested in these animal texts. I was working on them a month or so ago. And said, well, okay, I've got photographs of this. So this literally I've selected at random. And it happened, in fact, to lead into some really interesting things. So I thought it might be a nice experiment to kind of walk through with you here. This is a text that Halleck, when he published these Elamite texts, he assigned them to categories based upon the nature of the text. So this is what Halleck classified as an S2. That means nothing to anyone who doesn't know these categories. But what it has to do is that these are rations that are being paid out to animals. So animals are going to consume these rations. And this is the text, the Elamite text here I've translated for you. So a maris, that is a unit of wine, is allocated. The Elamite here is kerman. This is an interesting term and can be used in a lot of different ways, but we'll use it. We'll just note here as allocated. And here's the person who is allocating, datuka. So this is what we would call the supplier. And then this official here, Bagiza, he literally, the Elamite says he made the horses eat the wine. He didn't eat them, they drank it, but this is the seventh month of the 23rd year. You see, these texts, many of these texts are very abbreviated and just giving you the barest essential of information. Now let's look at the seals that are applied on them. I've mentioned to you that one seal is applied on the reverse and the upper edge. This is seal 25. Note that from our perspective, that is from the textual perspective, the seals are upside down. So that the top of the seal is up here and it's down here on this one. I'll flip it over in a minute so you can see better. This is not an unusual thing in the archive. And it's interesting also, you can probably just make it out here that the cuneiform, in fact, encroaches on the seal impression. In most of the places where we can see this, where we can have the text and the seal side by side, always the seal is applied first and then the text written later. There is a second seal. It's a stamp seal applied to the left edge. It is seal 105. These numbers were assigned by Halleck, and then Margaret Root and I have continued the assigning of these numbers. Here is the collated line drawing of seal 105, and now the collated line drawing of seal 25. Now, I've flipped over the tablet for you, so now we have the seal impression reading correctly, and the Elamite is upside down. Here's the left edge of the tablet. Essentially what I'm going to do is try to reconstruct the biography of these two seals very quickly for you. Now, seal 105 occurs on a total of 9 tablets identified to date. All right, so there are 9 tablets total that the seal occurs on. And you can see it occurs in 3 different categories of text. Don't worry about these categories. They're not critical for us right now. But seal 105 always occurs on the left edge of these 9 tablets. The supplier is always datuka. The product is always wine. The commodity is always wine. 5 of these texts with seal 105 place Dakuka at a place called Petana. So we can conclude fairly securely that seal 105 is being used by this fellow Datuka, that he's a supplier of wine and he's probably located at this place, Petana. Now, I won't go on any farther, but this guy, Datuka, occurs in other places of the archive so that we can extend his biography by looking at other texts that are associated with him. I won't indulge myself and bore you on the details of the career of that particular individual. Seal 25 is even more interesting from sort of a biographical perspective. It occurs on 31 tablets. So a fairly large number of tablets carry this seal. And as you can see, there are a lot of different types of transactions that this seal seal 25 occurs on. Now you're hoping, and I would be hoping if I were starting from scratch, that these texts are going to mention this guy a lot, because we hope that the seal in the reverse should belong to the receiver. The seal almost always occurs on the reverse, many times occurs on the reverse or the upper edge, and oftentimes with another seal, so just as we see it here. However, seal 25 can also occur alone on tablets without any counter seal. And this guy, Bagiza, occurs only on this text. This is from a perspective of trying to connect the seal to a user. This is not good information because we know we're going to have to do a little more work to figure out to whom this belongs. In fact, 8 different individuals are mentioned as the receiver in transactions that are sealed with seal 25. Now, we're fortunate in that 12 of these texts are L1, what we call L1, or a Halleck called L1 text. And these are ration lists that are payments to workers. And in 7 of these L1 texts that are sealed with 25, there's a Sharaman official mentioned, and his name is Karkish. Now, let me give you an example. This is text 911, one of these L1 texts that seal 25 occurs on. So we've got a unit of grain that is a kerman allocated by this individual. It is paid out to workers who are subsisting on rations at this place. And this is the critical part of it here, for whom Karkish is Sharamana, right? So that he's Sharamana over these officials. Well, the English translation of this is generally Karkish apportions the rations. That is, he's the person who sets the ration levels for those workers. And anyway, those workers have received these commodities as rations. Fourth month, 22nd year. And then we get a list of the workers and how much they are receiving. This list doesn't add up correctly, but that's not uncommon. The scribes will oftentimes make these small adding errors. This kind of profile that I've articulated for you here with seal 25 is generally indicative of a Sharamana official seal. So I think we can, with some degree of confidence, say that seal 25 is being used by this Sharamana official, Karkish. Now, the interesting thing about that, Karkish, of course, is not mentioned at all in our text that we started with. It is the presence of his seal that allows the overseers to recognize that this is a transaction in which Karkish is involved. So it's a beautiful example of the unspoken text associated with the text, the information that the seals are conveying to the accountants and the auditors. In fact, this protocol with a Sharamana official and a supplier is a common counter-sealing protocol. So this is a nice example of this sort of transaction. Now, a lot of information already on these two things. What we can now do is also look a little bit more at Karkish. This guy is a very important official. He occurs on a lot of texts and he performs a lot of functions. We've seen he's a Sharamana official. He's also one of these one of these regional directors. And under that, he uses seal 1. This is seal 1 down here. And he also is only one of a handful of individuals who carries a title Kurtabatish, which means the chief of the Kurtash, that is the chief of workers. So this guy is wearing a lot of administrative hats, and he's well known within the archive. Now, we can begin to think about the dialogue that's going on between these two seals that are associated with this specific individual at this particular time and place. Now, interesting. First, both of these seals carry inscriptions. This is very rare, right? Only 7-8% of these thousands of seals from Persepolis carry inscriptions on them. And to no surprise, they almost always belong to officials of high rank, because these are obviously special commission things that have inscriptions on them. Secondly, the inscriptions in both of them are very strange. Elamite inscriptions on seals, I don't have time to give you the whole spiel on them, they're very interesting, but generally they say personal name, son of personal name. I don't know exactly what we have going on here, but what is interesting is that we have the same word in both of the inscriptions. Unsha'ak. So it's unshak. Na is just the genitive and clid. And then this first line right here, which no one knows what in blazes it says. But then down here we have got probably a vertical and unshak. So here we have this word that occurs in both of these inscriptions. It's a rare word in the fortification archive. In fact, it doesn't occur anyplace else except on these seals. It does occur, however, in the treasury archive. The word, however, is known in other Elamite contexts earlier, and there's a good deal of discussion about what this word means. Is it a personal name? Is it an occupational designation? I think that the evidence here seems pretty clear that this has to be the title of an office. But it's interesting, again, that these two seals are the only two seals in the archive that have this very rare word on them. Now, of course, there's an interesting conversation going on between these two seals in their carving styles. Both of them, in fact, use a carving style that is very popular at Persepolis, which is a small modeled style of carving. We'll be talking more about modeled styles of carving. So that with these two seals, we can also begin to create, I think, a profile about artistic preferences, about stylistic preferences, about workshop affiliations that exist between known individuals and known seal carving styles. Now, you will have noticed already that the recovery of these impressions, which I am showing you for the most part in these reconstructed drawings, is a difficult endeavor, because no impression of a seal, or hardly ever will an impression of a seal, give you all of the information. So you literally have to have all of the tablets around you and grab bits and pieces of information to make this reconstructed drawing. And this is one of the reasons why people will shy away from the study of seal impressions like this, because it's extremely time-consuming to have to put all of this material together. But the results are, I think, worth the effort, because you can begin, this is taken from Volume 1, you can begin to get a feel for the lost physical matrix of the seal. So, for instance, you can even begin to get a feel for the size. This is the smallest seal in Volume 1 and the largest seal. These are all at the same scale here. Now, we've talked a little bit then about recovering these seals, and we've begun to touch a little bit on what do these seals represent from an administrative perspective. Seals, I think we can boil it down to two. Seals represent an individual, or they represent an office. Now, let me give you some examples of office seals. We can identify an office seal generally by the fact that many different individuals are using the seal in exactly the same way. That oftentimes is a key to understanding that you've got that the seal represents an office and that different people can draw on that office. I've already indicated that the regional directors, there are three of them, use office seals. Now, here again, this would be a wonderful study in and of itself, which no one has ever done, and that is to try to articulate the nature of the dialogue that is going on between these three seals that are being used by three of the highest ranking administrators within the archive itself. I could give you a few ideas on some things that I would talk about, but that would make a long lecture even longer, and I know you don't want that. But note how two of them carry inscriptions on them. And this seal three is just, well, it's unique design that has no comparable parallel anywhere that I know of in the first millennium BC. There are lots of suppliers who supplies that represent offices, flour, cereals, and grain, represented by these three seals here. Seal 10 is an odd one. I still don't exactly know stylistically and iconographically what to do with it. This is a beautiful modeled style seal here, and an interesting worship scene here that we'll talk more about next week when we do the seals of Zeshawish. And then there's a whole other type of text that are accounts. They are on big rectangular or square tablets, and they are sealed by accountants. I brought in three of account seals here. These may, in fact, be personal seals. It's really hard to know because the accountants themselves are rarely named in the accounts. Again, an interesting modeled style. This is an example of a local fortification style, and this great tour de force here of this animal winged creature with a fusion of Babylonian elements in it. personal seals, obviously we've got hundreds, if not thousands, of these. And I thought the easiest way would just to sort of give you some idea about the levels of seal users. And I'm thinking here social and administrative levels as well. At the very highest, we've got members of the royal family. This is Seal 38, which is the seal of Irtosh Duna. She's one of the wives of Darius and very active in the archive. What I would characterize as a neo-Assyrianizing seal. Obviously, it's got lots of Assyrian elements in it. There are also sort of the highest levels of individuals who are associated with the court. Gobryas, Aspathenes. I show you Irdumartia's seal 71 here, a remarkable archer scene. This is the one that we saw earlier in the treasury archive, and we'll have a reason to talk more about it in our fourth lecture. And then we've got these very high-ranking administrators that I've mentioned to you, Zisawish already. This is Barad Kama. His seal, it carries a royal name inscription, that is, it names Darius on it. This is another one of the seals that also occurs in the treasury archive, so we happen to have here two of the four seals that are in both of the, that occur in both of the archives. And then the Sharamana and Damana officials, there are ranks of Sharamana and Damana officials. They're not all equal in their administrative rank. Here are some that I think are sort of the mid-rank fellows. Abatia's seal especially is a beautiful design. Note how 815 and 98 are very similar in composition, the fact that they have inscriptions, and also stylistically the same. So again, an interesting study which I would propose is to look at this kind of phenomenon, and then a local fortification style here. But note also it carries an Aramaic inscription. And then large number of seals that are of officials of low rank. Many suppliers are very low rank, deliverers, agents, various lackeys who are running errands for the higher ranks. I don't know exactly how many seals are preserved in the archive because I haven't had a chance to actually count them all. I have, however, cataloged over 2,000 different seals to date. Now, one has to remember that there are still 1,500 Elamite tablets that I've not examined, and so there are going to be more new seals in those, and thousands of uninscribed tablets as well. So I think by a conservative estimate, we are looking at something between 3,000 and 3,500 different seals that are preserved in this archive. I mean, can you think of any other visual resource that is as concentrated in time and place as this? In fact, many of you may be aware of the Beasley Archive. They have a website where you can go and learn about black and red figure vases. And I did a search on the Beasley Archive for all red figure vases that are produced in the period 530 to 475, and I got this total. In other words, our seals are comparable to the total number of known red figure vases that at least exists on the Beasley Archive. Now, of course, that doesn't account for all red figure vase production, but note that our time frame here is much broader than the time frame of the fortification archive. In other words, this is a phenomenon of imagery that is equal to, if not greater, than what's preserved in Athenian vase painting. Very briefly, let me just run through some of the compositional character. And again, we'll talk more about some of these things in the later lectures. We've published already the heroic encounters. Their next volume, which I hope will come out next year, will be scenes that have other humanoid figures in them. a wonderful corpus of Archer images from the archive. I think around 75 different seals showing Archer imagery. Not a lot, but a small corpus of hunt scenes, and then a nice substantial corpus of chariot scenes that show individuals in chariots. A very large and substantial corpus of scenes that show cult imagery, which will, without, I think, going overboard, I can say, will rewrite the history of our understanding of religious imagery in Persepolis at this time. And we'll have a chance to talk about that a little bit in the third lecture when we look at the so-called fire altars. A nice corpus of banquet scenes as well. And then many hundreds of scenes that show just animals, mainly animal variations of animal combats, but also these heraldic scenes. And we've seen several times, we have a nice corpus of these creatures with crossed necks. Important for those of you who know a little bit about the so-called Neo-Elamite glyptic. This is one of the scenes that Amier and others have argued is a specifically characteristic of Elamite glyptic, but I've tried to talk about those in other places. And then these isolated animal studies, we've seen several of those, and then a large number of abstracted geometric and floral devices as well. You will have seen also a lot of a wide variety of iconographic influences. We've seen several individual elements and whole seals that are neo-Babylonianizing, such as this stamp seal here. We've also seen examples of Assyrian imagery. I'm thinking mainly, of course, about this elaborate floral device and the figure in the starburst here. And then, of course, we've got some things that one would normally associate as Persian or Iranian. In this particular case, I'm thinking about the depiction of the so-called Persian court robe. It will take someone other than me to bring together the complete definitive work on a stylistic analysis of the seals from Persepolis, just because it's a massive undertaking and really would require, I think, someone to start at the doctoral level and carry it through for the whole of his or her career. I can tell you, however, that we have a local style that I've called the fortification style, this what I call Persepolitan modeled style, this fantastic archer scene on 115 here, and then the so-called court style. We'll talk more about this both in the discussion of the seals of Szyszkowice and also in the last lecture dealing with the ideology of the images and its interface with monumental relief. And I apologize for doing this very quickly, but I really don't have time to go into this in any detail. Well, obviously, you can see that this imagery is remarkably important on numerous levels. It is, I think, without equal as a corpus of imagery, either within Western Asia or indeed I would extend into the Greek world. Think just for instance, what is the corpus that we have at our disposal for the study of archaic sculpture from Greece? Or even add Ionia to that as well. A fraction of what we have here, dated to exactly, of course, the late archaic period by the Greek reckoning. And this imagery is not simply the same thing over and over. Now, this is not to disparage some of these remarkable archives from the Hellenistic period, which have hundreds of seals in them, but it's like the same animal stamp seal over and over and over. Again, I don't mean to say negative things about those. It's just that by comparison, this imagery is without equal in its complexity. We know where these images come from. We can point to a place in the ground in the fortification wall, and we know they came from there. And we know the site from which these tablets come. This site is not someplace in the outlands or the periphery. It's the imperial capital of the largest empire that existed in the ancient Near East before Alexander. Not only do these images have a provenance, per se, but their usage is exactly dated by the accompanying text. Now, this is a complicated question, and I don't mean to say that all of these seals were cut, that is, engraved in this period, but they're certainly all used, and I would argue most of them date within the generation of Darius or the generation before. Of course, we do have these remarkable heirlooms that I haven't even brought in to talk with you today. And of course, these images are associated with those texts, and those texts tell us oftentimes the name of the seal user, the function of the seal user, the administrative rank of the seal user, even sometimes the social position of that seal user as well, and in many cases, the exact places where those seals were being used. Again, I've just brought in here various things as I run through this. There's a beautiful strain of this abstracted geometric carving style that occurs in the Persepolis glyptic. It's an inheritance, again, from the Neo-Assyrian period. You've seen seals carved in this style and with this imagery also when I was talking about those letter orders. This actually is used by an accountant. And then this remarkable cult scene that is preserved here with a very strange inscription. I won't go into the details of that. Now, obviously, with a corpus that is so rich, there is an agenda that must be undertaken to attack this material. And again, I will not be able to do all of this, but hopefully people will come along who will be interested in doing some of these things. They include, for example, just finishing the cataloging, which I don't know if I will be able to do that. And I've mentioned to you already, we need stylistic analyses of this material, especially ones that focus, I would say, on the fortification style and the court style, because they are critical. A wide range of iconographic studies on a wide range of material. I have become very interested in the interface between this glyptic from Persepolis and monumental relief, and what that interface tells us about monumental relief, the new context that it provides. We'll look at some of that in lecture 2 and then the lecture 4 as well. And you probably will have seen that I'm very interested in these inscriptions on seals. We need a comprehensive epigraphy of this material, and then studies that integrate the imagery to that epigraphy. An important and I think critical way of accessing this imagery is via its administrative context. Many years ago, I wrote a very rough attempt to do such a thing, dealing with these so-called J-texts that have this phrase dispensed before the king. But I think that there are lots of other groups of texts that would repay the same type of study. I have convinced a graduate student in Chicago to look at the seals of the accountants, so he's working on those. I've not yet convinced anyone to work on the seals that occur on the T-text, but anyone who wants to undertake that, these are remarkable seals that occur on these T-texts, and there are some very interesting stylistic and iconographic patterns that occur. Remember, these are the letter orders that occur. And obviously, we need a comprehensive study of both these Sharman officials from a textual standpoint and also the types of seals and imagery that they use. And the cues are just waiting for someone to study them. It would be very interesting to look at the supply seals by geographic region to see if there are stylistic patterns that emerge in regions, because these suppliers are coming from known places, some of them farther towards Elam, others farther to the east. And another very interesting study would be look at the seals of the travelers who are coming, we know, from outside of the Susa-Persepolis nexus. Many of these travel rations tell us that a traveler is coming from Arachosia, or they're coming from Sardis, that they're not local, as it were, to the system. What I would call for then is, I guess, something I would qualify as a prosopography, of images from Persepolis. That is the public careers of this imagery and groups of imagery. And I tried in a very elementary way to do that with this Seal 1 and Seal 25. I've mentioned to you also the interfaces between this imagery and the individuals who use this use these seals. The interfaces of the imagery and other images in the archive, and indeed the greater culture milieu at Persepolis at the end of the sixth century. And really, we're talking also about a comprehensive synthesis of glyptic in the first half of the first millennium. Because in order to understand this material, you must know the Assyrian material, you must know the Babylonian archives as well. So Persepolis and these seals then are essentially a summation of the previous 500 years of glyptic in Iran and Mesopotamia. Merci beaucoup.